Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for joining me. In a few moments, I'll be shining the spotlight on two very different age groups. Children, because on the 20th of November we happen to be celebrating Universal Children's Day. And the elderly, because they were the subject of a meeting sponsored by the Pontifical Council for Health, Pastoral Care in the Vatican last week. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Let's begin then by taking a look at the 22nd International Conference sponsored by the Pontifical Council for Health, Pastoral Care, which took place in the Vatican from the 15th to the 17th of November. A conference which focused this year on the pastoral care of sick and elderly people. Indeed, Pope Benedict XVI chose to meet with the participants at this conference on Saturday, the last day of this meeting. To all present, he proffered words of encouragement, inviting them to defend human life with courage and dignity. Lydia O'Kane reports.
The Pope, in a heartfelt address, said, "If it was true that human life in its every phase was worthy of the greatest respect, then this was made ever more true for the sick and the elderly." He added that old age constituted the last stage of our earthly pilgrimage, having different phases, each with actual lights and actual shadows.
Perché? Quando la sfida della malattia si fa drammatica.
The Holy Father then posed a number of questions. One asks, he said, does the life of the human person continue to make sense when faced with old age or illness? Why, when the challenge of the illness is very serious, continue to defend life? Why not accept rather euthanasia like a liberation? And is it possible to live with an illness as a human experience and to take it on with patience and courage? With these questions, Pope Benedict said, one is called to be there for elderly and sick patients, especially when it seems there is no possibility of recovery. The current mentality of some efficiency-minded people, the Pope said, was to treat these, our brothers and suffering sisters, like a weight and a problem in society. Always, he added, next to indispensable clinical care, it is necessary to show a concrete capacity to love, because the sick need understanding, comfort and encouragement.
In più occasioni, il venerato mio predecessore Giovanni Paolo II, che specialmente...
Recalling the sufferings of Pope John Paul II, the Holy Father said, on many occasions my venerated predecessor, especially during his illness, demonstrated exemplary belief and courage, urging scientists and doctors to commit themselves to research and to treat the illnesses that come with aging, without ever yielding to the temptation to cut short the life of the old and sick with medical practices that would end up being a form of euthanasia. In conclusion, Pope Benedict exhorted those present to work always to spread the gospel of life. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
And our thanks there to Lydia O'Kane for this report on the Pope's words pronounced on the last day of this conference, which brought to Rome many experts in the field of care for sick elderly people, among them guest speakers who represented other religions, including Judaism, Islam, Buddhism and Hinduism. They discussed subjects ranging from demographics, illnesses within the context of globalization, how personal, technological, scientific, socio-political and ecological situations impact on these illnesses, but also care for sick elderly people in Holy Scripture, the writings of the popes, the witness of saints in the church in this area. One of the speakers there was the president of the British Geriatric Society, who focused his attention on the history of care for sick elderly people. He's Professor Peter Crome. Let's listen to what he told me.
The specialty of geriatric medicine, interestingly enough, started in the UK after, with the inception of the National Health Service after the Second World War. But the general principles about how best to care for older people, and particularly those who have multiple disabilities, both physical and mental, is a universal requirement. And the trends that are taking place in the UK are mirrored by trends taking place elsewhere in the world.
I was expecting you to say that it started much earlier than that, but I mean, by that I meant centuries earlier.
Yes. Well, of course, caring for older people has taken place ever since time immemorial. One can go back into biblical times and find, for example, the story of King David and his treatment for hypothermia, and there are a number of other examples. But what I've been talking about recently is how the application of modern medicine, medical techniques, surgical techniques, medical techniques, rehabilitation techniques, and our knowledge of palliative care can be applied in a systematic way to older people.
Older people then are more numerous today. What does it mean? What does it entail in terms of medicine?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the numbers of older people are increasing quite dramatically, both in the developed world and in the less developed world. In fact, the numbers of the proportion of older people in the population in the less developed world will increase even greater than it will be in the West, and therefore the issues that we've been talking about are relevant throughout the world.
You mentioned that technology has impacted on the way you care for sick elderly people. Is that correct?
If I can just give a couple of examples. When I qualified as a doctor, it's not so long ago, patients who had a cataract operation were cared for in hospital, they were in for a week, they needed a general anaesthetic, etc. Nowadays, cataract surgery is done as a day case, and in some countries it's done as a sort of mass production line. We've got hip replacements, knee replacements, we have keyhole surgery. We have implanted pacemakers. All of these have been of great benefit to older people, and because of the technological advances, they can be undertaken with much less risk, I should say, to their health.
So in a sense, nowadays, care for sick elderly people takes place at home a lot, no?
Yes. One of the other changes that has occurred as a result of the growth in the number of older people has been the realisation that it cannot be provided in hospitals. The cost is prohibitive, again, but throughout the world. So we've got one hand the desire to reduce the costs of taking place in hospital, and the other hand to respond to what most older people want, not all, but most, and that is to be treated at home or as near to home as possible. And that's resulted in the growth of what we call in the UK community care, domiciliary-based care, and the changes that are taking place in the UK are taking place in the rest of the world as well.
Except that, for example, in developing countries, obviously the infrastructure is a very different one, and two families are much more present in taking care of the sick elderly people than perhaps in Britain, no?
Well, that is certainly the case. If you don't have any other facilities, then it has to be provided in whatever facilities are taking place there. But I would say that trends such as urbanisation are taking place in the whole world. And one hears about the development of care homes and other types of facilities in the less developed parts of the world, just as they have been developed in the UK.
Can we go back a moment? Can we step back? We've been talking about what's happening now. Can we go back to the beginnings
yes,
of
sure,
this?
Sure. The situation in the UK, I think, has been different from the rest of the world. As you're aware, in the Middle Ages, care for sick, frail, older people was provided by religious organisations. The monasteries, for example, regarded this as their responsibility. But a particular situation happened in UK with the dissolution of the monasteries and the development of alternative facilities provided by local ratepayers, local taxpayers, which turned eventually into the workhouses of the Victorian era. And these then transferred in the 1930s under the control of local authorities, municipalities, and it was these that came into the National Health Service in the 1940s. And I think in the UK, it was the only country which has in existence this network of state-run hospitals for the frail elderly, which had to be brought into the National Health Service and which had to have doctors provided for them, nurses working in them and therapists working in them. And that is why in the United Kingdom a nationwide geriatric medicine service was established much sooner than in other countries.
When you say much sooner, you mean 20 years earlier? Or?
Sure, something like that. I mean, I think it's still the case that there are more geriatricians per head of population in the UK than there are in any other country in the world. And if it hadn't been for this historic situation, I don't think it would have happened or that would have been developed less quickly as it has been in other countries.
What were the major challenges then, do you think, in terms of organising the work compared to today?
I think the challenges are in the way both similar and different. Similar in that you needed to have a trained and dedicated workforce who are interested in working with older people. They had to have evidence on which to base treatments. And as evidence has developed, of course, that can be implemented, but it raises other research questions. One has to have adequate facilities, and of course the facilities which we require are judged against the changes in society, so that whereas previously it was regarded as fine to look after people in wards of 24, 28, now the norm would be to everybody to be in a single room or a double room. So that's an example of how things change with the times. And perhaps I think what is probably the most important thing is to treat older people with dignity. And that's one of our big campaigns at the moment, to apply some of the principles of human rights to the care of older people, the right to dignity, the right to privacy, the right to respect, the right to life.
What we're trying to do in an organised fashion, people in more primitive cultures do naturally, in a sense.
Yes. Well, I would think as far as caring for one's family is concerned, family solidarity is still the norm in the developed world. And I think it's often said that young people don't look after their parents. Of course, that does happen. But the majority of care in the UK and other developed countries is still provided by families for their older relatives. And in fact, some of the changes that are taking place, the migration of younger people away from the families, seems to have stopped happening.
In Britain, you have a multicultural society now. How has that impacted on the system in any way? Or?
Sure. I mean, you've raised a very important issue, and one that we perhaps are not handling as well as we should do. Everybody's different. We know about our own a cultural group, religious group, social group. Most healthcare professionals know much less about other sections of society, and what we regard as normal may not be regarded as normal in other sections of society. So there's a big educational job to do here, particularly in those parts of the country which have large sections of the community who've emigrated to the UK from other countries. So there's the educational aspect. Then there is the provision of what might be kind of sort of individualised services. I mean, most obvious example might be to make sure that in hospital there is a sufficiently broad range of food available so that everyone has the opportunity of having food that they're used to and like eating.
Regarding preventive care, is that part of the geriatric area?
Yes.
Because we all get old.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, modern ideas suggest that prevention of disease in later life actually starts before you're born and takes place and is important throughout childhood, early adulthood and into later life. And the general principles are, I think, well known. The most important thing you can do for your health are not to smoke, not to drink too much alcohol, to take regular exercise and not to be overweight and to eat a good healthy diet. Medication is important to prevent a number of conditions at later life, particularly if you have early warning signs, and there are a range of treatments that are available to prevent stroke, heart attack and other conditions. However, even if one gets to a ripe old age of 80, it's not to say that there aren't still measures that are worthwhile taking. Perhaps the most effective measures are still the simplest ones. Exercise, which could be quite moderate, just walking upstairs instead of taking the lift, doing some standing up from a chair a few times a day. Again, moderation in diet. And some things which have a more social function, maintaining social activity, maintaining some type of intellectual activity, maintaining contact with friends, going on outings. All of these things seem to have a positive health-giving effect, as well as being enjoyable.
That was the president of British Geriatric Society, Professor Peter Crome, one of the speakers at the 22nd International Conference, sponsored by the Pontifical Council for Health Pastoral Care, which took place in the Vatican from the 15th to the 17th of November. A conference which focused this year on the pastoral care of sick and elderly people. And now we go from shining the spotlight on the elderly to shining the spotlight on children. I've picked this particular theme simply because the 20th of November marks the day we celebrate Universal Children's Day, a date which coincides with the day the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Declaration of the Rights of the Child in 1959, although already in 1954 this Assembly decided to foster a day of worldwide fraternity and understanding between children. So stay tuned, but watch the change of pace and tone, because the manner I've chosen to mark this day is rather unusual. There's a saying, children will be children, even down the centuries. So let's step back then in time to the days of the Romans and quiz our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. Vatican Radio used to have a co-production with UNICEF.
Oh.
We used to do radio programs together. How would you translate United Nations Children Fund?
Nationum Unitarum Opes Pro Pueris.
In November 1954, the United Nations General Assembly recommended that all countries institute a Universal Children's Day. So how do you say Universal Children's Day?
Universalis Puerorum Dies.
Anyway, I went on a couple of these reporting jobs for UNICEF in various countries.
Mm.
Of course, as you know, it's an organization which is a leading advocate for children's rights. How do you say that?
Propugnat in primis puerorum jura.
Active in 190 countries.
In centum nonagenta nationibus actuosa.
Through country programs and national committees.
Per incepta singularum nationum atque comitatuum. Bene.
How do you say reporter from the Vatican?
What are you going to say? Baes auceps, auceps, notia Vaticanus, notitiarum auceps.
My first reporting job was to a nation often referred to as the rooftop of the world, a Hindu kingdom.
Ah.
How'd you say the rooftop of the world?
Tectum orbis.
And the Hindu kingdom of Nepal.
Ah, bene, regnum nepalense, hindorum.
Would the Romans have known about the Hindus?
Well, the Hindus, maybe not the Hindus, but they knew people out in the east. I mean, with the traders and stuff coming, you know, west, they knew that there were people out there.
But they never went to Nepal.
No.
Then my second trip was to South Africa. The Romans wouldn't have been to South Africa.
No, they just had North Africa, actually only the coastline. And you know what they used to have on their maps for the rest of Africa? Hic sunt leones.
Here are the lions.
That's all they could say about the rest of Africa.
My reporting job was focused on children, and I had to cover two very different situations. So the first focused mainly on child trafficking in Nepal, no? They had this child trafficking, and Nepali children were taken to the Bombay brothels, no? Did the Romans have child prostitutes? Was there child trafficking at the time?
No, not child prostitutes. They had children involved with sex, but I don't know, child prostitutes, no.
Was there trafficking of children or slaves or something like that?
Oh, yeah.
How do you say child trafficking?
What are you going to say? Puerorum mercatus, negotiatio puerorum.
How were children considered? Were they considered sacred?
Well, for sure. But I don't know, the mortality rate was so great. It was kind of sad, and people just kind of came and went and disappeared.
My second reporting job for UNICEF, that's for UNICEF, was in South Africa where I met with some former child soldiers, because my reporting job was focusing on the post-apartheid violence. That was the theme of my reporting job.
Oh, boy.
So did they have child soldiers, the Romans?
No.
When did they start?
You had to be quite old, and you had to pay for your own way. You had to pay to get in the army.
So it was a privilege?
In the old days, yes. It was considered a privilege.
Because they were well paid, or because it was
you had to bring your own equipment and buy all your own stuff. It's a different kind of approach, and this was your duty to the fatherland.
So anyway, my reporting job in South Africa focused on how post-apartheid violence affected children. How'd you say post-apartheid violence?
Oh, apartheid, what are you going to say? Violencia. Post-segregationem.
And I didn't ask you how you say child soldier.
There you go again. You could say puer miles, miles puer, parvulus miles.
Anyway, at any rate, all situations dramatically removed from what is dictated by the Convention of the Rights of the Child. We don't have to read the convention, but we know that within that convention there's surely the right for children to play, no?
Mm-hmm.
Roman children played.
Oh, yeah. Certainly they had games and they had toys and they had all that.
So what did they... They played nuts, the equivalent of marbles, I read?
Yes.
How'd you say that?
They had a whole thing, nucibus ludebant. Nucibus ludebant with, like, walnuts.
But they played with knuckle bones or pebbles as well.
Yeah. And certainly they used to carve, you know, ivory cubes, like, okay, your dice.
Oh, but the adults used to play dice.
Oh, yeah, from your foot there.
So how do you say knuckle bones? And the Romans played with knuckle bones and pebbles and rolled metal hoops.
Oh, my Lord. Yeah, I know. The metal hoops is a verbero. Ergo volvebant verberones. That's the hoops. I don't know, knuckle bones. What are you going to say? Osa articulorum. Oh, they had everything.
Yeah. The little girls had dolls as well, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Even in Pompeii, we had, like, you know, carts and little horses. Well, they had everything that we have today, for sure.
What do you mean, carts and little horses?
I mean, they had, you know, model horses and
like
wagons.
Toys.
And toys, yeah, certainly. Yeah.
Toys representing the life of life.
Yeah, certainly. Oblectamenta, ludibria.
Those toys were for rich children, no?
Mm.
Maybe poorer children just made little carts with a bit of wood, and I read that they had little mice or pigeons to pull them.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
How would you say that?
Well, we have pictures like that.
How would you say that?
Avivan colum, mures, vel palumbes, qui traherent curus, caros.
And they must have played what you call in the States tag, no?
Oh, yeah, my, yeah.
How'd you say tag?
What do you understand by tag? I know, you know. What are you
going to
say?
We call it chasing.
Yeah, I know. What are you going to say? I don't know. Tactus est vera, you know, tactus, well, contractatio, where you touch someone.
And what about hide and seek? Would you say that?
Oh, no. Oh, bene. Se abscondere et querere. That's easy.
And hopscotch?
Oh, my heaven's sakes. How are you going to say I would? I don't know. That thing with the, you know, saltatio per quadra. Jumping through the squares. What are you going to say? Saltatio, boom, per quadra.
And they like to play games, as we said before, with dice and things like that. And they used to play things like, you know, what we do too as well, when you toss a coin, no?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And in, at school, you used to say,
heads
I win and tails you lose.
Yeah.
How'd you say
well,
that?
Well, they had the same thing. Capita? What do they say? Capita. Yeah. Caput me vincente et
Navia.
Navia. Maybe, yeah, where they had like with tails, in the sense like a ship on the back. That would be possible with the head and a ship. They had things like certainly the Roman coins.
So cheating again, heads I win, tails you lose, how'd you say?
Si accidit caput vinco, si cauda evenit perdo.
They were great gamblers, the Romans, weren't they? Those were.
Oh, yeah.
How do you say gambling?
Oh, that's another one. That's hard to do, too, you know. I'm trying to think. Someone asked me, you know, blackmailing. The Romans didn't have for blackmailing. What are you going to say? Per sortes. Lude bon per sortes. By lots.
They gambled of everything, didn't they? They had cockfights and all the rest of it.
Oh, yeah.
Blackmailing, you were saying?
Yeah, blackmailing. Someone on the phone wanted blackmail. I said, there's not one word, but they say extorquere minis, to extort something with threats.
Getting back to the children, did they go to the baths at all? Because the adults spent a lot of time in the baths.
Yes, they did. They did with their parents. Yes, they did. Babies were taken there.
Did they swim?
Certainly.
How do you say?
Certainly.
Throw the baby into the thermal pool.
In piscinam infantulum proigere.
Would you say that the children were respected and that they did have rights in the times of the Romans?
Rights, I don't know, not rights. That would be hard to say as we understand rights. Respected, oh yes. Oh, yeah, but as we would understand rights, perhaps not.
How would you describe it?
Because, you don't understand, because the children were subjected to their father. What's called the patria potestas was extremely strong. The father had control over his children as long as he lived, even if the kids were 50 years old. And the father was 90, he still had control over the children.
So the Romans never grew up? How'd you say that?
Well, numquam adoleverunt. Numquam adoleverunt Romani. They never grew up. But there are incidents, really, where children, even older adults, disobeyed their parents and were killed by the parents.
That's pushing it a bit far, no?
Well, that was they had that sacrosanct thing. It was patria potestas, fatherly authority.
If you had to explain to children today what the Roman children were like, if a child asked you today, Father Foster, what were the Roman children like?
Well, I would say, listen, all you have to do is change your clothes a bit and put on a little toga or a little one of those little cut-off, you know, dresses up to your knee and sandals. Habevan tuniculas. Et satis es mutare vestimenta ut fiatis pueri Romanorum. That you become children of the Romans. Am pervenimus ad lunam, interia nil est vita humana mutata.
Which means, in English?
Which means we have gotten to the moon, but the human life has changed nothing.
Heartfelt thanks there, as always, to Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who's currently working at the Vatican's Secretariat of State as the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. By the way, at the same time tomorrow, you can hear the fourth in my series of programmes focusing on papal social encyclicals. We've reached the pontificate of Paul VI, and we'll be taking a look at Populorum Progressio, 40 years on.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.